I want you to just close your eyes for a second. Imagine you're standing on the surface of Mars. It's desolate, radiation levels are spiking, and above all, it's just incredibly bitterly cold. Now, imagine you have to build a radio that works there, but you can only use parts you bought from an online electronics store.
That's effectively the job description for high altitude ballooning. Everyone focuses on the photos, the curvature of the Earth, the black sky, and they're beautiful, don't get me wrong. But from an engineering standpoint, it is an absolute nightmare of an environment.
Specifically the cold. And we aren't talking about, put on a heavy sweater cold. We're talking about temperatures dropping to minus 70 degrees Celsius.
Right. And at minus 70, materials stop behaving like materials. Rubber shatters like glass. LCD screens just go pitch black. And batteries, standard batteries, usually just give up the ghost completely.
Which brings us to today's deep dive. We're looking at a specific engineering test from the Stratosonde project. This is a high-altitude probe that's designed to just linger in that hostile environment for days. We're analyzing a very technical entry from their development blog titled Ceramic Capacitor Bank Validation, the Final Power Layer at Negative 70 Degrees C.
But this isn't just a story about a battery, though. It's really a story about trust. The engineers knew their primary systems were going to fail. They knew the physics would betray them at a certain temperature, so they had to design a safety net, a final line of defense, and then prove that it would actually catch the system before it hit the ground.
It's a validation of a failure mode, which I just think is a fascinating concept. Usually you test things to prove they work. Here, they're testing to make sure it fails gracefully.
Exactly.
So let's set the stage. We have a probe. It's floating at, 20 kilometers up, and it needs to send a radio signal home. What is actually powering this thing?
Well, it's not just one battery. It's a hierarchy. They call it a cascade architecture. You have to imagine it like a bucket brigade for energy, sort of passing the load down the line.
Okay, let's walk through the brigade. Who's the first person in line?
The first layer is the heavy lifter. It's a 2SLTO battery. That stands for lithium titanate oxide. Now, this isn't your standard phone battery. Your phone uses lithium ion with graphite anodes. The problem with graphite is that when it gets cold, lithium ions, they struggle to find a parking spot in the graphite structure. It gets sluggish.
Like trying to merge onto a highway in heavy traffic.
That's a perfect analogy, exactly. But LTO is different. It uses this nanocrystal structure on the anode, which means there's a massive surface area. It's not one highway on-ramp. It's like 1,000 on-ramps. This allows ions to move very freely, even when the temperature drops. So LTO is chosen specifically because it is incredibly robust in the cold.
So it's the marathon runner. It holds the bulk of the energy, but maybe it's not the fastest sprinter.
Precisely. Batteries are chemical engines, and chemical reactions take time. If the radio suddenly screams, "I need power now," for a transmission, the battery might say, "Hang on, I'm getting there." And that lag causes the voltage to drop, which can crash your computer.
So you need a buffer.
Enter layer two, the supercapacitor. This is a 1.5 millifarad storage tank that sits between the battery and the radio. It can dump energy much, much faster than the battery. Its job is to smooth out those spikes.
But as we're about to find out, supercapacitors have an Achilles heel.
They do. They contain a liquid electrolyte, basically a solvent with salt dissolved in it. And liquids, as we know, generally do not like minus 70 degrees Celsius.
Which leads us to the hero of our story today, layer three, the safety net.
The ceramic capacitor bank. These are physically small components. I mean, tiny chips you lose in the carpet, but electrically they're very fast. And crucially, they're dry. They're made of solid ceramic and metal layers. They don't freeze because there's nothing inside them to freeze.
So the theory is the battery provides the long-term energy. The supercap handles the spikes. But if it gets so cold that the supercap freezes and fails, these tiny ceramic chips are supposed to step in and keep the radio pulses alive.
That's the theory.
Uh-huh.
In engineering, theory is just a hope until you test it. And that's what this blog post details. They built a test rig, a kind of Frankenstein version of the power system, and threw it into a thermal chamber to basically torture it.
I noticed something interesting about the setup in the notes. They deliberately used a wrong component. The ceramic bank they tested was only 408 microfarads, and the notes say this was undersized for the actual mission. Why would you test a safety net that you know is too small?
That's a classic data science trick. Think about it. If they used a massive ceramic bank that could handle the whole load effortlessly, it would smooth out the voltage perfectly. You wouldn't be able to see the exact moment the supercapacitor failed because the ceramics would just hide it.
Ah, so by using a small bank, they make the system more sensitive. They actually want to see the jagged edges in the data.
Exactly. They want to see the handoff. Imagine a relay race. You want to see exactly when the second runner trips and drops the baton to prove the third runner can catch it midair. If that third runner is too good or too fast, you might miss the fact that the second runner tripped at all.
Got it. So they're stress testing the physics, not just the capacity. Now let's look at the challenge they threw at this system. They didn't simulate a full power radio blast. They used a 25 milliamp pulse for 60 milliseconds. That seems, well, tiny.
It is tiny, but it represents a specific scenario.
Yeah.
A degraded transmission. When the Stratosaun detects that it's freezing to death, it enters a kind of survival mode. It lowers the radio power and sends shorter messages. It's basically a distress whisper. I'm still here. I'm cold. Here's my data.
Okay, so the stage is set. They put the components in the chamber. They turn on the distress signal pulses, and they start dropping the temperature.
And at first, everything is boring, which is good. Down to minus 55 degrees Celsius, the system is just humming along. The data shows an effector capacitance of almost 19 millifarads.
Wait, let me pause you there. 19. You said the supercap is 1.5, and the ceramics are tiny fractions of that. Where on earth is 19 coming from?
That's the battery showing off. When you measure effective capacitance in a circuit like this, you're basically measuring how well the voltage holds up under load. Because the battery is warm enough, relatively speaking, to push current easily, it just refills the capacitors instantly. So the system looks like it has this massive tank because the tap is flowing freely.
Okay, so the door is wide open, the battery is doing the heavy lifting, the supercap is just a pass-through, everyone's happy.
And then we cross the threshold. The engineers drop the temperature just 2 degrees further, from minus 55 to minus 57 degrees Celsius.
And looking at the charts in the source, wow, it is not a slip, it is a cliff.
It is a vertical drop. That massive 19 millifarad number just vanishes. Instantly, the reading drops to 560 microfarads.
The blog post has a fantastic quote for this moment. It says, "The supercap has turned into a potato."
Yes, which is scientifically accurate in a way.
So physically, what happened in those 2 degrees? Why does it go from working great at negative 55 to potato at negative 57?
Right.
That seems incredibly sharp for a natural process.
It is sharp, and it's due to something called the glass transition. This is a specific phase change. Inside the supercapacitor, that electrolyte usually acts like a watery syrup. Ions can swim through it to store and release charge. As it gets cold, sure, it gets thicker. But at the glass transition temperature, it undergoes a phase change. It stops being a liquid and becomes an amorphous solid.
Like flash freezing.
Ideally, freezing implies forming a crystal lattice, like ice. This is messier. It becomes disordered but solid. Imagine trying to run through water. It's hard, but you can do it. Now imagine the water instantly turns into concrete around your legs. That's what happens to the ions.
They're trapped.
They are locked in place. And if the ions can't move to the electrodes, the capacitance disappears. The device is physically still there, but electrically, it's gone.
So the supercap is technically still there, but electrically, it now has high impedance.
Sky-high impedance. It becomes a resistor, a wall.
Okay, so the second runner has tripped. The supercap is down. Did the third runner catch the baton?
They did. And this is the successful failure the team was looking for. The supercap died, but the system didn't crash. The measured capacitance leveled out at roughly 408 microfarads.
Which matches the ceramic bank exactly.
Exactly. The ceramics didn't care about the cold. They just took the load. Yep. The voltage dipped, sure, because the buffer was smaller, but it didn't collapse. The radio pulse went out. The handoff was perfect.
This validates the whole architecture. You have a component that fails and a backup that just ignores the failure condition.
Right. But, well, the story doesn't end there. The engineers saw this and probably thought, great, the ceramics work. Now let's see how low we can go. They probably expected a linear decline. You know, it gets colder, things get a little worse.
Physics had a surprise waiting for them.
A nasty one.
Let's talk about the hard floor. They kept dropping the temperature, minus 60, minus 62, still hanging on. But then they hit minus 65 degrees Celsius.
And the lights went out.
The data here is stark. At minus 66 degrees, the battery voltage, not the capacitors, the battery itself drops to 2.8 volts. At minus 68 degrees, it's 1.8 volts. And by minus 70, it's at 1.8 volt.
Yeah, and ideally, that battery should be sitting at 4.8 volts. So at 1.0 volt, it's useless. It can't run the processor. It can't run the sensors.
It's dead.
It's chemically inert. And this is the most critical insight from this entire document, the difference between high impedance and low voltage.
I want to drill into this because the blog highlights it as a fundamental lesson. It feels like a distinction that's easy to miss if you aren't an electrical engineer.
Okay, think of it this way. The supercapacitor failure at minus 57 degrees was an impedance failure. The energy was still in the battery, but the pipe through the supercap got clogged because the fluid froze. That's a problem you can engineer around. You can sip slowly through the clogged pipe, what we call trickle charging, and eventually fill your ceramic capacitor.
It's like drinking a thick milkshake through a coffee stirrer. It's annoying, it takes forever, but the milkshake is still there.
Exactly, you just need patience. But the battery failure at minus 65 degrees, that was a voltage failure. That's a thermodynamic limit. The chemical reaction that pushes electrons simply stops happening. There is no push left.
So that's like trying to drink from an empty cup.
Correct. Doesn't matter how big your straw is, doesn't matter how long you wait, there's nothing to drink.
The blog puts it so bluntly. You cannot charge a capacitor from a voltage source that provides no voltage.
It sounds obvious, but in the heat of testing, it's a profound realization. You can't circuit design your way out of a chemical shutdown. When the chemistry says, I'm done, you're done.
So we've established this death zone below minus 65. But before we completely write off the battery, I found a weird anomaly in the data tables. They called it ghost capacity.
Ah, yes. The zombie battery effect.
Between minus 58 and minus 65, so inside that zone where the supercap is a potato, the effective capacitance was actually higher than the ceramics alone. The ceramics are 408 microfarads, but they were measuring 430, 450, sometimes 490. Where was that extra energy coming from?
It was coming from the battery fighting for its life.
But I thought the battery was blocked by the frozen supercap.
It was mostly blocked. The supercap had high resistance, but not infinite resistance. During that short 60 millisecond radio pulse, the battery was managing to shove just a tiny amount of current through that frozen sludge.
So it was backfilling the ceramics in real time.
Exactly. It shows just how robust this cascade architecture really is. Even with the supercap frozen solid, the battery was still contributing something. It wasn't dead yet. It was just struggling. It's actually quite inspiring for a circuit board.
I'm not dead yet.
I can still give you 20 microfarads. Take it.
So bringing this all back to the real world mission, the Stratosonde is a balloon. It goes up to 20 kilometers, maybe higher. Is this minus 65 degree hard floor a mission ender? If they hit that temp, do they just fall out of the sky?
Fortunately, no. If you look at the standard atmospheric models, at 20 kilometers up, the temperature usually hovers around minus 56.5 degrees Celsius.
Okay, so let's check our zones. Minus 56.5 puts us right in the
ceramic-only zone.
So the supercap will likely be frozen. It'll be a potato.
Most likely. But the battery will still have voltage. It's above that minus 65 degree floor. So the battery will trickle charge the ceramics through the resistance. The ceramics will fire the radio pulses, and the mission continues. They have about a 9 degree safety margin before the battery chemistry collapses.
That is comfortable, but not exactly luxurious.
In aerospace, 9 degrees is a luxury. Usually you're fighting for decimal points.
Now, the blog mentions a change for the final flight hardware. They aren't going to stick with that tiny 408 microfarad bank they used for the test.
No, that was just for the data resolution like we discussed. The flight version upgrades to 1.5 millifarads. That's roughly 3 times the size.
Is there a downside to that? I know weight is everything on a balloon. Every gram you add is a gram of payload you can't carry.
I ran the numbers on this. We're talking about maybe 15 small capacitors. The total weight is roughly 7.5 grams.
7.5 grams? That's less than a packet of ketchup.
And the cost is about $5. To gain reliable operation in the most critical phase of the flight, it's the easiest trade-off an engineer will ever make. You pay 7 grams to ensure your radio works when the stratosphere tries to kill it.
So if we zoom out, what's the big takeaway here? Is it just that ceramics are great?
That's part of it. But I think the bigger lesson is about success through redundancy.
Mm.
They didn't try to find one magic battery that works perfectly at minus 70. It doesn't exist.
Right. If it did, our phones would work a lot better in the winter.
Exactly. Instead, they layered imperfect technologies. The battery is great at storage, but slow. The supercap is fast, but hates cold. The ceramics are small, but invincible. By stacking them, the weaknesses overlap to create a strength.
It's a team effort. The battery covers the energy, the supercap covers the buffer.
And ceramics cover the panic moments when the supercap freezes.
Exactly. And they also learned where the wall is. Knowing that minus 65 degrees is the hard limit allows them to plan the mission profile. They won't fly blindly into a temperature that physics just won't let them survive.
The blog ends with a bit of a teaser for the future, though. They mention Acetonitrile-based electrolytes.
Yes, that's the next frontier. Acetonitrile is a solvent that stays liquid at much, much lower temperatures than the standard stuff used today. If they can switch to that chemistry, they might be able to lower that hard floor from minus 65 down to maybe minus 80.
But for now, they have to respect the chemistry they have.
You can't argue with thermodynamics. You can only prepare for it. That seems like a good philosophy for life, not just engineering. You can't change the weather, but you can definitely pack the right gear, or in this case, the right capacitor.
Well said.
Thanks for diving deep with us into the freezing physics of the upper atmosphere. It's a reminder that sometimes the most important part of a high-tech system is a $5 handful of ceramic chips.
Absolutely.
To you, our listener, here's a thought to leave you with. We always assume technology will just keep getting better, batteries will last longer, chips will get faster, but this experiment showed a hard stop, a wall where chemistry simply said no. If we do switch to those exotic new electrolytes the expert mentioned, do you think we'll just find another wall at minus 80? Or is there a point where we can truly engineer our way completely out of nature's constraints? Something to think about. Check your batteries, stay warm, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.